Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. In today's episode, we will discuss fiscal policy in the EU, starting with its present, but also looking backwards in order to assess what we need to do in the future. Here with me to discuss these issues and a lot more than that are Rolf Strauch, who is the Chief Economist and Management Board Member of the European Stability Mechanism, the ESM. Hello, Rolf.
Hi, hello, Maria.
Thanks for joining us. And Zsolt Darvas, who is my colleague at Bruegel and a senior fellow here. I am Maria Demergis, and I'm the deputy director of Bruegel. Thank you both for joining me to discuss what is, no doubt, a topic that we're going to see a lot more of in the coming year, and that is the fiscal policy and how perhaps to rethink the way that we do fiscal policy in Europe. But before we go there, let's start with the present. And I turn to you first, Rolf. We've seen an unprecedented fiscal support that was given during the pandemic at the national level, across all EU countries without any exception. But we've also seen what I would describe as unprecedented architectural innovation, if I may call it this way, in the form, of course, of the Next Generation EU Fund, where the EU innovation was basically common borrowing. Now, we still do need to finalize that because we have not put the final lines on how we're going to pay this back. And there's also scope for innovation as well. And I wanted to ask you, what is your take in terms of both the size of the support that was given across the national and supranational levels and the effectiveness of the fiscal response that we're given?
Thank you, Maria. To kick this discussion off, I mean, let me make a relatively bold statement by saying that I think we got it right. So that Europeans got it right in their crisis response. And that is what we can confirm now, when we see actually how it works and the economic repercussions. We are in the recovery phase and fully fledged. So the economy is kind of bouncing back at this stage. And we see much less of scars than we had anticipated, even not so long ago. And here, I think this has to be crucially explained by the policy reaction and by the policy measures taken. I mean, you know it, the first set of policy measures broad-based across the board was to provide liquidity support, provide immediate help. That was central bank measures, national measures, and European measures. There was the first package with the European Commission, European Investment Bank, and the ESM to provide liquidity support. And then the second point was, and you already alluded to it, is that we and Europe actually in the first place formulated a recovery concept, a recovery vision. And then that is why this institutional innovation of Next Generation EU came into place. And there we are now at the start of implementing it. I think it went off for a good start so far, and we may be discussing that in more depth. So if we look at the economy now, against all those measures, we see that firms are doing relatively well in a sense that we have not seen the amount of bankruptcies that many had expected, and that was because the liquidity was provided to the firms. We may see more bankruptcies coming forward, but by far not, I think this is commonly agreed, the kind of big tsunami that one may have feared to see. In the labor market, we see less frictions in the labor market than one may have feared before, and certainly less than we saw after the past crisis. So that is performing relatively well. And also what we see, what I think is very important, is we see a high degree of popularity of the euro. And that has to do with those measures, right? So the fact that we come out of this crisis and you see 80% support for the euro for this common project, for me, is also a consequence of the kind of measures that were taken. This is to say, so far, so good. Obviously, there are challenges out now that we have to address, and it's not a foregone deal that everything will be working, looking right, and that is what you alluded to. So more needs to be decided and more needs to be done in order to really make that recovery work.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll come back to what needs to happen next. But if we can just take stock of where we are now. And Zsolt, do you share Rolf's assessment that we got this right? And I think I wasn't quite what Rolf said, I mean, but there is a comparison to be made with the previous crisis, the financial crisis. Probably we didn't get it right back then. And again, that is not what Rolf said. But what do you think, Zsolt, did we get it right?
Thank you, Maria. Compared to the aftermath of the global financial crisis and the subsequent euro area crisis, I very much agree that this time European policymakers and politicians did much better. And Rolf already listed the number of positive developments that we are observing now in 2021, even though the last year was a really dramatic year. Nevertheless, let me nuance somewhat the developments. Now, first, if we do a transatlantic comparison, then again, what we see is that the United States is recovering much faster and much stronger than the European economy. Now, there could be a number of reasons for that, but certainly one reason is the really large-scale fiscal support in the US, initially by President Trump and then subsequently by President Biden, which is certainly almost a magnitude larger than the fiscal support we provided in the European Union. Now, the jury is still out how effective the US support was. It also had a different composition, which we could discuss, and how effective the European support is or was. But certainly, the all projections suggest that in the US, there was no reduction compared to the pre-COVID trend line. So basically, if you drew a line for the period, let's say, from 2020 to 2019, then the US economy went back to the trend line. While unfortunately, the European economy did not go back to that trend line, and it's persistently below that. So there is a gap which we need to explain and ideally close. Another comment is on insolvencies, which I very much agree with Rolf that it didn't expand much. But one reason why it did not happen is that insolvency laws was also amended, suspended in many, many countries. And when this will come to an end, so the jury will come out when this will actually end, and then we will see how many companies were able to survive. Nevertheless, I strongly believe that even after that, the current situation will be much better than after the global financial crisis and the euro crisis, exactly because there was a massive state support, liquidity support. Companies were, and also support for employment, quite importantly, throughout the European Union. So many companies were able to survive the huge shock of falling demand in the past 1.5 years than during and after the euro crisis.
Can I briefly come in maybe on this?
Yes, please, Rolf.
For this comparison of the different crises, the past crisis in the euro area and also now the comparison with the US, which I think is important also to take some considerations into account. Some people say that in the past crisis, what was done was a mistake. Let me also point out that the past crisis had a different character. So some of the recipes that work now with the pandemic crisis didn't work in the past because you had to also address different kind of imbalances. And for the country that we are closest in terms of ESM relationship, Greece entered this crisis in a very different situation compared to the past one, also because of all the reform measures that were taken in the last one. The same, you can say, like all the measures that were taken in the banking sector to make the banking sector healthier, were obviously a condition also for the banks in this crisis to be in a much better position to support the economy. So I do not say that everything that in the past was done was right, but I think we clearly need to recognize the differences in the type of crisis and also that the fact that past reforms were taken actually helped us in this crisis. That's one point. The second point is on the comparison with the US, where many people said they do it right because they engineer this kind of pressure economy. I think you can do that under certain circumstances and with a view to the institutional setting in a different country. So with the US, given the exorbitant privilege, given the financial structure that they have financing space, and they used that financing space And they also compensated for the fact that their social insurance system is less developed and broad than it is in compared to the euro area countries, in order to give broad income support. In Europe, we took a different way, and I think rightly, by focusing on company relationships, on employment, because that is where the biggest frictions emerged. And obviously, also, we used the social insurance system. So that may be less money, so to speak, in order to put pressure, the economy under pressure to grow. But I think it's a very effective way of handling it. And of course, we will now have to see whether we make the final mileage that Scholz referred to in also reaching again the trend line. We maybe have not done it as quickly, but I think we have done it in an efficient way given the European institutional setting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the comparisons can only go that far because, you know, in all actually bumps and growth instances, the US is a lot more flexible. We know that. And therefore, it may go into deeper troughs, but it's actually quicker to bounce back. So I think this is a feature that is known in the US. The question is the cost of meeting the crisis. And, you know, what is the bill and how are we going to pay this bill back? Because that's what it comes to. And it depends very much on how we're coming out of the crisis. And now, as we are beginning to think about removing some of the measures that have artificially sustained the economy, as Joel said. And I think this is the next point to discuss is what happens next. So a number of rules were suspended during the 2 years almost 2 years and 1.5 year of the crisis. We need to think about going back to some of the rules. There are good reasons why we have those rules and need to go back to them. Is it the speed, of course, at which we go back is something that is important? And also, what do we go back to? And I think, you know, this is the one issue that will be debated here in Brussels is how do we go back to a fiscal coordination framework? And is it the current one we go back to, or do we need to rethink about that? And I'm sure you both have lots to say. Joel, you've written a lot on this. But in order to answer that question, and certainly for the benefit of our audience, I would like us to discuss a little bit the role of fiscal policy, both in the past and in the future. Because I think we are now two once-in-a-lifetime crises, two in the space of 10 years, where fiscal policy had to play a very active role. And we have a fiscal policy regime in the EU. Do you think that this is fit for purpose in the future? If we can go back and evaluate the fiscal framework that we had, did it serve a good purpose? And can it sustain this purpose in the future as we move forward, given the challenges that we come ahead? And in fact, this next year, we're going to celebrate 30 years of Maastricht. So I think that's kind of a good time to take stock and think about, has Maastricht served us well? And can it serve us well in the future? Zolt, what's your take on this?
So Maastricht and more generally the architecture of the euro area was basically built on two main pillars. One is fiscal sustainability and the second one is price stability. So price stability was sought to be achieved by giving the new European Central Bank a strong power to follow the steps of the monetary policy of the German Bundesbank. By for fiscal stability, the Maastricht criteria, I mean, in particular, the 60% of GDP public debt ratio and the 3% budget deficit limit was so to deliver such a stability from that side. Now, since then, we know that these two are not enough. Financial stability is similarly important. But now let me talk and focus more on fiscal policy and on fiscal rules, as you highlighted. Now, already when this 60% public debt ratio threshold and the 3% budget deficit threshold were decided, already at that time there were question marks, what is the economic rationale behind these numbers? And since then, we have seen a lot of evolution of the fiscal framework. Most importantly, in the early 2000s, Germany and France were unable to meet the 3% deficit threshold. And instead of finding these two large countries, a major fiscal framework reform followed, whereby the rules were made more flexible. Also, after the global financial crisis, and in particular the Greek crisis, which started in 2009, in 2011, 12, and 13, there were again a lot of new reforms to the European fiscal framework in the so-called six-pack, which changed how both the so-called preventive arm of the Stability and Growth Pact, when a country does not have an excessive deficit, and also the corrective arm, when a country has an excessive deficit, how these two major arms should evolve. A new numerical definition was given or defined for the requirement of reaching the 60% of GDP public debt ratio, which is the so-called 1/20th rule, whereby in each year countries have to reduce the gap between their actual debt level and the 60% threshold by the 1/20th of this gap. And I mean, what we have seen after the euro crisis a decade ago is that many countries entered an excessive deficit procedure, so they had excessive deficits. Many of them received a lot of flexibility, extended deadlines, and lowered pace of fiscal adjustment. But overall, I think the consensus, and also this is my view, fiscal adjustment after the previous crisis was too fast. And not just in hard-hit countries, which were either under program like Greece or under severe market pressure like Italy, but also if you look at, let's say, Germany, which even during that time had a very, very credible fiscal position, consolidated much faster than it was required by the European fiscal rules, and also much faster than what was required by the German national debt brake rule.
So what are you saying, Zsolt, if I may? You're saying that the fiscal rules have implied the fiscal policy has been unnecessarily restrictive?
No, what I say is that the fiscal rules were applied in a flexible manner for those countries which were unable to meet them. And also this includes, for example, France and Spain, two countries which received a lot of deadline extensions in extending the deadline for correcting their excessive deficits. But for some other countries, and I mentioned Germany, which is certainly the largest country, fiscal consolidation voluntarily, so it was the decision of the German parliament and government, progressed much faster than what was required by the rules. And I mean, this second element, I think, was, at least in my assessment, was a policy mistake. Fiscal consolidation should have not progressed that fast after 2010, as it actually happened. Now, for the other countries, for the more hard-hit countries or countries which faced some market pressure, I think there was not much choice but to do fiscal consolidation. And especially after Mr. Juncker became the president of the Commission, a lot of flexibility has been applied in this regard. A flexibility is also reflected, for example, that in this 1/20th debt reduction rule that I have just mentioned, it was never applied seriously. So Italy and Belgium frequently violated that rule. But again, building on the flexibility, which said that, for example, when a country implements a major structural reform, then this debt reduction rule can be overlooked. So this kind of flexibility mechanism has been used. Actually, that rule was not enforced.
But can I just come in here? Because the rationale of the Maastricht Treaty, which, and you said, Zsolt, that there was not much agreement on what the actual limits were on the numbers. Well, I mean, I think the one thing we can agree about, though, is that the rationale of the Maastricht Treaty is that there's a need for fiscal coordination in the monetary union. I don't think there was a disputed point when the Maastricht was created. But on the role of fiscal policy, which I think is important, in particular if we're going to say something about the future, back in the 90s when the book was written, there was no role for fiscal policy. There was no role for discretion in fiscal policy. It was just automatic stabilizers. That was textbook fiscal policy, and the Maastricht rationale followed that textbook policy. So the fiscal policy was never there to be used in any other way than just automatic stabilizers. What happens is then, I think, you know, can we look back and say, well, actually there was space for fiscal policy and it wasn't used, or it was a choice to be used, or it was used excessively? How do you see fiscal policy operated in the past 30 years? And let's say start with the first 20 before we get to the last decade. Rolf?
Well, from my perspective, I think Scholz got it right in saying that the fiscal rules are fundamental. The fiscal regime for monetary union is fundamental, obviously, as a mechanism of trying to control fiscal policies, because market mechanisms by themselves don't do it. I think I would not agree with your formulation. There was no role for discretionary fiscal policies in a way. We need to be very conscious that the fiscal rules have a very specific objective, which is debt sustainability, and they need to have a limited intrusion into what national governments can do. So they were confined. And yes, then they focused largely on the operation of automatic stabilizers under those rules. But obviously, there's a very broad scope of discretionary fiscal policies. Then even in a crisis, I think that is why we have the escape clause. And we have benefited from the escape clause now, and we have benefited from the escape clause in the last crisis. So there is a role of discretionary fiscal policies also in that regime in order to support the economy. I mean, for me, backward-looking and forward-looking, this is about making the fiscal rules more effective, right? So they have worked to some extent in the past, but you wouldn't have had a debt crisis if they would have worked perfectly. Scholz described also that they didn't work really nicely over the cycle. And above all, the creation of buffers in good times hasn't worked, and that constrained fiscal policies in the bad times. And that is what I think we need to be looking at now. And I hope today when the Commission will start this kind of public consultation on the fiscal framework, that this will be the objective, making the fiscal rules more effective. Now, before the crisis, the pandemic, there were already points why we said that we should be looking at this, and they have to do with the complexity, and Scholz mentioned all the elements that add to it. And the second point had to do with measurement, the output gap, where the consensus on how to measure the appropriate fiscal stance to some extent had broken down. Now, we go through the crisis and come out of it, and then I think that has kind of strengthened the need of looking at the rules in how effective they can be. And the additional elements are measurement becomes even more complicated after such a crisis to measure the output gap. But the second point is that also the situation with a view to debt has changed. Obviously, governments incurred a lot of debt during the crisis, and I think it is okay that they did this in order to support the economy, but this makes the achievement of the 60% and the 1/20th rule even more difficult, and maybe in some cases even economically too costly to get there. So that is something that one has to recognize. Other element is that interest rates are very low and make financing more affordable in that regard. And even though interest rates will increase, debt carrying capacity has probably still is higher nowadays than at the days when the 60% rule was put in place. So I think these are all elements that need to be taken into account. Moreover, forward looking, we see big investment needs. Why I think it would make sense to also have a fresh look at how we want to handle debt in that fiscal framework. And again, in order to try to be effective in the design of fiscal rules.
So in fact, if I may summarize, because it would be nice to sort of move forward on what to do next. So Zsolt, I'll come to you in a minute, but just to summarize, there are three things that we need to take into consideration as we move forward. Low interest rate environment, that's on the favorable side because it means the financial needs are lower. But on the unfavorable side, we have huge debts. We've built them up as the legacy of two crises for a number of countries, but also investment needs. And there on the investment needs, if you think about the climate, just the one, the investment needs, and Isolde can tell us a little bit more about those investment needs in a minute. Those investment needs on the public side are going to be huge. On the private side as well, we need to find ways of mixing these two. How should we think about the fiscal framework, adjusting some of the rules, when you have to deal with huge legacy of debt and we have probably sizable investment needs? Zsolt.
Just let have a very quick reaction. In fact, I would like to emphasize one very important point that Rolf has said, when he said that in the past, in good times, countries did not accumulate sufficient reserves. And indeed, I think there's a quite general consensus in the literature that fiscal rules did not constrain countries in good times, because in good times, you know, it's when the housing market, let's say, is booming and there's a lot of tax revenues, then it's very difficult to see what is the more fundamental underlying position of public finances. The number of countries made a mistake that they believe that such booms will continue forever. And unfortunately, fiscal rules were not suitable for containing such a development, constraining countries in good times, which I think is almost as important or perhaps even more important than what is allowed discretionary in bad times. But looking to the future, I think the central challenge will be that if and when the current fiscal rules will be reactivated in their current form, and I have to say I give a very large probability that this will actually happen, because in most likely scenario, rules will be reactivated starting from January 2023. Now, countries will have to prepare their national budgets according to the rules, and they typically plan their preparations in the spring of the previous year. So the national budget will start being prepared from spring 2022, let's say less than a half year from now. And I can't really imagine that within half a year, a major reform of the fiscal rules will be agreed. So my baseline scenario is that rules will restart from 2023 as they are. Now, from that point, countries will have to do fiscal consolidation, except very few countries like, you know, Luxembourg and Sweden, which have very, very low debts and very low budget deficits. But all other countries, including all the big ones, will have to do fiscal consolidation. But as you rightly mentioned, Maria, Europe has very ambitious plans to fight climate change, which will require a lot of investment. And a quite significant share of that investment will have to come from the public sector. So basically, in the years to come, more and more public investment have to be made in the fight against climate change. But at the same time, all countries will have to start fiscal consolidation. And I'm afraid that these two things will not happen simultaneously. If you look back again in the history and look at historical episodes of fiscal consolidation, we do see that public investment was actually cut almost everywhere. And again, the reason is relatively straightforward. When a government has to choose, let's say, between cutting, you know, spending for building a new bridge or, you know, reducing pensions or public sector employment wages or something other current expenditures, then it's much less painful to cut and postpone an investment than, you know, cut current spending. And I think this bias, which is well understood also from a political perspective, will always remain with us. So we'll need to do fiscal consolidation. And at the same time, we will need not just to maintain the level of public investment, but even increase. And I'm really afraid that these two things will not happen. Now, we also hear that in the case of Germany, there are some, you know, tricks going on of the creating a new special fund in 2022 when the rules are not yet active. So some tricks are perhaps being made in a few countries. But overall, across the European Union, I think this will be the challenge of this decade, how to increase public investment at the same time when fiscal consolidation will have to be made.
You have a very sober outlook, Zsolt. You're saying that we need to go back to the current set of rules. You also say that the current set of rules are not fit for purpose because we have huge investment needs. So one of the two needs to be sacrificed. Unfortunately, that will be the investments, right? That's what you say. So we can forget about our climate ambitions, if I read you correctly. Rolf, do you share the Zsolt's pessimism?
I don't know whether it's pessimism or... But my perspective is that first, there will be naturally some consolidation just by those temporary measures that were taken for the crisis to phase out. That is what we can expect and what we should expect. So then the question is, will there be more consolidation or should there be more consolidation beyond that, and by what kind of framework that is governed? So I do agree with Scholt that the probability of having new rules in place is not very high at the time of next spring when the budget is planned. But that does not mean that one could not formulate some kind also of, politically formulate some kind of a transition period where some support can be maintained. So that, for me, is a political question. And from that, I would not deduct that we cannot find an operational framework. And that can still be somewhat different from how the fiscal rules will eventually look like if we cater for a transition period and how we want to address the long-term challenges. Now, on the long-term challenges and the link with the climate change, I do agree that climate change investment will be an important component, obviously, of future fiscal policies that we have to address. It's broader than that. I think also convergence is an important issue that we need to have in mind and we need to have resilience in mind. Thinking of all of this, it's clear that cannot be fiscal policies only, but it has to be structural reforms as well. And a big part has to go to the private sector, and the private sector has to deal with it. And we can talk about that later on. So can we secure climate change? Should we secure climate change policies over that period? Yes, I think we should. We should, with all the measures that we have. That may mean some reprioritization of public spending. It may mean that incentivizing the private sector to do the right things. And it may mean that also maybe taking initiatives at the European level in order to support forward-going climate change beyond what is done currently in Next Generation EU. At this stage, Next Generation EU at the European level and implementing it has priority and is probably the best we can do for climate change. And that will carry us through the next couple of years. And from there, we will also learn how we can go forward and can take better informed choices in that regard. So I do not think that what we envisage now is incompatible with adequately dealing with climate change. I do agree that it would be good to have a clear transition regime if we cannot agree on new fiscal rules. And again, I also said, as I said before, I think it would be good to have a very good discussion on how we can make the fiscal rules more effective.
But can I ask, I mean, realistically speaking, and it's not just about the political will to design a transition phase. There are countries that are very heavily indebted. I mean, the fiscal space for some countries, it just isn't there. We have legacies that need to be financed. How are those countries going to meet equally ambitious climate needs when the investment needs, certainly on the public side, of course on the private side, and we can do things to incentivize the private to be involved more. But without the public contribution there, it would be difficult to steam dry that. How do you do that when you have huge legacy debts?
Maybe let me take this up straight away, because obviously, as I said before, also Greece having the highest debt in the euro area is clearly on our mind. And when I say at this stage that I think that public debt is sustainable in euro area countries, I also keep Greece in mind. And I have mentioned the factors before, right? That is, low interest rate have tremendously increased debt carrying capacity. If you think about highly indebted countries, they pay typically much, much less interest rates today than they did with lower debt levels before. And that is just an indication. And we probably can agree in this round that interest rates are going to increase. But I think we probably can also agree that they will not increase to an extent as we had seen maybe prior to the past, to the global financial crisis, that we get back to the old regime, at least not for the foreseeable future over the next decade or so. Now, having that in mind, that is what allows me to say that I'm not overly concerned by having high debt levels per se. What I do say is that it still requires kind of a clear degree of fiscal discipline, in a sense that you need to have a credible fiscal path of addressing it, because that is what will sustain market confidence. So you need to have a clarity on how you want to deal with it, but that does not mean that by all means you kind of need to rapidly reduce debt levels in order to have sustainability. There is, from that perspective, there is discipline required, but not exaggerated consolidation.
I'm actually glad you brought the issue of the credible paths here, because I don't want to get in the discussion as to where the interest rates are going to go anytime soon. That's another kind of worms discussion. We'll have a different podcast on this. But I mean, if the central bank the ECB finishes this QE program, that interest rates will go up by themselves, and it will not be through monetary policy, it will be through the financial fragmentation. So the risk associated with the credibility paths that still need to be designed and the interest rates going up is still there, and it's very visible, and it very much depends on what the ECB is doing. So I still don't know how are we going to prevent that from happening, and how are we going to ensure that the fiscal needs that we have in the future can be met by country needs only. Still not clear that we can have equally ambitious climate objectives when the fiscal space is very different between countries. It's a circle that I cannot close, if you like. But Zsolt, come in the discussion.
I very much share, Maria, your risk concerns and risk assessment. Namely that, you know, currently we are all very happy about, at least from the public finance perspective, about the low interest rates. But this might not stay with us forever, partly because the ECB might, as you say, sooner or later will reduce and eventually stop its massive quantitative asset purchases. We also do not know what will happen to inflation. Currently, we see a big spike in inflation. Now, all the central banks argue that this is just a transitory phenomenon. I mean, let's hope they are right. But if not, and in particular, if it starts to to spill over into increase in other prices, the low inflation era might be behind us. I mean, we do not know at this moment, which will immediately necessitate higher interest rates, and then that financing cost will increase. And let me add another factor that when we look at the literature on the impact of climate change on growth and also the impact of public climate or green investment on growth, the results are not really clear-cut. Even the European Commission impact assessment of the transition to the net zero suggested that there are scenarios in which, in fact, the growth impact will actually be negative. There are also scenarios in which the growth impact will be positive, and the Commission uses the new Green Deal as the EU's new growth program. Nevertheless, if you look at the details and also at the other analyses, I mean, climate change actually can make public debt more difficult to sustain, not least because, for example, due to extreme weather events, which will necessitate more public resources. Overall, if you do the transition fast, then still currently productive brown activities will have to close down, jobs will be lost. So overall, whether green investments and climate change in general will increase productivity and output, that's not that clear-cut. And there are scenarios in which actually all these climate-related issues could actually lower productivity and GDP. And at the same time, if we spend more by the public sector, so public debt is going up while GDP is going down, then the fiscal sustainability challenges can be even more serious. So that's why also in one of our recent papers that I wrote with Guntram Wolf, we discriminated between two sets of countries. I mean, we did not say which country belongs where, but we said that there are countries that currently have weaker fiscal positions and countries which still have strong positions. So countries which have weaker fiscal positions, we were very cautious, not really suggesting a big expansion of spending. But there is also good news, I have to say, that if you look at the distribution of next generation EU funds, so the EU's recovery money, then we see that to a very large extent, it goes to countries with large public debts, like Greece, Italy, Portugal, will get significantly more than, let's say, Western European countries. And as we know that, 37% of recovery money has to be spent on climate change. So what we did advocate is that indeed countries which have a shakier fiscal position for the next, let's say, 5 or 6 years should rely on the next generation EU for their green public investment. They should not receive a special treatment for other additional green investment, and that can be sufficient.
And they will. I mean, it's not they should, but they will.
But for countries, let's say, like Germany or even the Netherlands and France and other countries which do not have such debt sustainability constraints, what we suggested is that a good solution would be to exclude the increase in net public investment in green activities from the fiscal rules, because that would create incentives to do more green investment at the same time when the budget will have to be consolidated.
So you're arguing for differentiation of the rules, as it were.
Yes, differentiation, okay. Depending on positions, on yeah. The fiscal space. Yeah.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at the time, and there is two things more that I would like to touch and ask you both, because I think they're important in this conversation. I don't want us to close this podcast without referring to the Next Generation EU Fund, how you see that as an innovation, temporary, permanent, and why. But I also like to ask you, if you were to make one change to the fiscal rules, or this discussion needs to start, what would that be? And I'll start with you, Rolf.
Well, thank you for now also letting us address a bit more broadly the fiscal structure or the fiscal challenges that we see forward looking. So in this regard, Next Generation EU, we know it is temporary. I think, again, as I said before, we had a very good start. And what we should also consider with this good start is indeed the amount of structural reforms that were put into the programs and that actually now put forward by member states. Now, of course, the most important part is actually to follow up on those, to implement those. And also for that, there are steps and governance in the programs to try to ensure this. I think from Next Generation EU, what we can do forward looking and take away, as in my view, as positive lessons are two points. The one point is that it creates a positive incentive scheme for reforms. And if we look at the country-specific recommendations that are now complied with in member states, that is, or at least is included in the programs, it's much, much higher than what we have seen in the past and more comprehensive, more ambitious. So from that perspective, one lesson out of Next Generation EU forward-looking would be this. The next one, obviously, is also with a view to climate change. It's good that it is envisaged to be financed by green taxation, climate-related taxation. So that's also a positive point that one can take forward. What I would like to take forward beyond Next Generation EU, yes, there is the question, can there be some kind of a follow-up? We know Next Generation EU is temporary, but could one, for example, find other means in the EU budget to implement such a scheme to further support green investment? Is one of the questions that we have. The other point, I think an issue that we still need to address is this issue of resilience also that you mentioned. And of course, I mean, with risks being there, we cannot exclude that also forward-looking crisis may emerge. And therefore is that what we think is that a permanent fiscal stabilization facility that complements national capacity would be helpful. We are a crisis resolution mechanism, so when really it becomes very tough, we step in. But there can be downturns, there can be other situations where this such a stabilization mechanism, a central fiscal capacity, could be good. And then there are different ways of organizing it. Many proposals have been made on that. I think if we put this together, we get to a more complete fiscal financial infrastructure for the euro area. But again, I can only make the point that I had before is it cannot be all the public sector. So we need to think about further recovery. We need to think about for climate change in the private sector and what we need to do there. The same holds for resilience, holds for risk sharing. And here just those agendas on banking union, on capital market union are crucial. And we are not discussing it right now, but obviously there's a lot to be said about this, how elementary and fundamentally they are in securing future growth and us being able to deal with climate change.
But do you think, Rolf, that the Next Generation EU Fund is a good template for designing such a fiscal centralized capacity?
From my perspective, the two are different things. Next Generation EU is, in its very nature, more related to convergence and structural change. That is what it wants to achieve. Yes, it is now also used to get out of the crisis, but it is not per se a stabilization mechanism. Stabilization mechanisms like a rainy day fund, as they are discussed, they come into place in order to really address short term a crisis and provide support. And then you can also direct expenses or the support towards investment, but not necessarily so. So I think by nature, they are different.
But effectively what I'm asking, I should have just asked that, is that the size of this fiscal stabilization mechanism is much smaller than the next generation. You found the way that you describe it, right? Do I understand correctly?
So the size that have come across and is mentioned in the literature is above about 1 to 2 percentage points of a stabilization fund. So these are kind of magnitudes that are mentioned in the literature.
Indeed.
Already with 2%, you can provide effective support.
Yeah. Right, now that's very clear. Zsolt, your final thoughts. We've heard what you would like to change in the rules about the exclusion of investment for green needs. On the next generation EU fund, what's your take?
Let me pick up a point from Rolf on possibly using the EU budget more or any other EU facility for financing climate change. And the reason I would like to pick that up, because in fact, the next generation EU can be sought as a kind of tool to flood fiscal rules, because the EU-wide borrowing will be paid back by member states. But since this is EU-wide borrowing and ex ante, we do not know who will pay back how much in the next 3 decades, that component of next generation EU, which is distributed by grants, will not count as the public debt of member states. So basically, the EU borrows about 2.5% of its GDP that redistributes across member states, but this 2.5% of GDP is not counted anywhere as a public debt of European Union countries. The case is different for loans. So for those which is a direct loan, let's say to Italy, Portugal, Poland, and the other countries, that will be counted as public debt. But the grant component of next generation EU is not counted as a public debt. But this also means that if something similar would be done with the climate expenditures, then this would be, you know, a clever way for excluding green public spending from fiscal rules. Because if, let's say, we set up a new EU fund, let the name be, so the Future of Climate Fund, that fund would borrow in the name of the EU. The repayment of that fund would be similar to the NGEU, namely that member states would pay that down in 3 decades from regular contributions. It means that that fund would be not counted as national public debt, and the spending from that fund would not be counted as budget deficit. So that could be a clever way of circumventing fiscal rules and giving countries fiscal resources for climate investment, which don't count into fiscal rules. There will be a further additional advantage of that, namely that all green investments funded by that fund would be approved both by the European Commission and the Council, meaning that national green investments would be fully in line with the European priorities. So in fact, setting up such a fund could be a good way of circumventing fiscal rules. But then comes a very tricky question, you know, whether the fund should involve redistribution, as next generation EU does, and also as the general EU budget does, or not. Because if there is redistribution, then I think there is no chance that such a fund would be agreed. I mean, we need massive climate investment, and we already saw how difficult it was to agree on the redistribution, which is involved in the next generation EU. So I don't see any political chance for such a fund. But if there is no redistribution, you know, then countries paying back what they get, then the whole beauty of this whole thing would disappear, because then we would know each country paying back. Then Eurostat might decide that, look, this fund actually has to be added to national debt. So there is some options for flouting fiscal rules and using a new EU fund for creating more fiscal space for green investments. But it's not that clear cut, and a lot depends on whether there is redistribution or not.
Can I please just add to this?
Yeah, very quickly, yes, please.
I think the purpose of none of this, not of next generation EU, and whatever, if anything, may follow, should be to circumvent the fiscal rules, right? You know, the next generation EU has a fundamental positive purpose of trying to engineer recovery and also do it so that those that lost most are helped more. Forward-looking, I think, for any such facility, or if you use the EU budget, the point would be support climate change mitigating policies. That's the positive thing that one wants to achieve. And I personally think also, as I said before, we need to be mindful of convergence. And an element of convergence in supporting countries, that way of a solidarity consideration, could also, should usefully be in order to fit the purpose. And that would be the objective.
I very much agree, Rolf, very much agree that the fundamental goal is the fight against climate change. But my major worry is that when we will reinstate fiscal rules from 2023, then the conflicting needs of fiscal consolidation and increased public investment will not be satisfied simultaneously. One will be lost, and really afraid that green investment will be the losing part in this race.
Well, if I may, I was hoping to finish with Rolf's upbeat message, but I can't help and listen to Zolt very carefully. Listen, I think there's been absolutely fascinating. There's more questions than answers here. But thank you both for sharing your views on this. I think you both make very important points. I certainly share Rolf's original point that we are now at a much better position than we were 10 years ago, architecturally if only, but also we've learned from mistakes of the past. And, you know, this crisis was managed a lot better than the previous one simply because we had the benefit of insight. And that's not to be underestimated in view also of the challenges that we are going to face in the future. But with that, I think we are coming up to an hour now, and I would like to thank you both for joining me today. That's all from us for today. If you're interested in following our work, please join us at www.bruegel.org. A very big thank you to my guest, Rolf and Zolt. Thank you for joining me, and to you, our listeners, for joining us today. See you next time. Bye-bye.